That's what I asked. Yes. It's time for me to kill.
Yeah.
Okay, the title of my talk is something about the THZ coordinates. It's a coordinate system that I learned about some years back, and I found that it's...
Carlos!
I found the THZ coordinates to be a particularly convenient and physical way of viewing cell force problems. Okay, Bernard, you too. Okay, thank you. In any event, that was the title of my talk. So I seem to be technologically challenged these days, and I had trouble with my laptop, which seems to always happen at just the wrong time, or else it's just my excuse, I don't know. But anyway, I decided two things, and one was to make the THZ part of the talk pretty brief. And then I wanted to really talk about some other things that I'll get into in just a second. And so I'll do the THZ part first. And that is, this is Thorne, Hartle, and Zhang who wrote out this system. It's a particular coordinate system which is locally inertial, Cartesian, and harmonic. It's a harmonic coordinate system. There's a length scale in the system, which I'll call curly R, maybe it's the time scale or the curvature, length scale associated with the curvature, or something on that order. And we find in this approach of trying to find what we call the singular field, in all problems that we've looked at, the singular field is remarkably elementary to write down as a mathematical formula. The singular field for the scalar singular field happens to be equal to, in this coordinate system, Q over R plus terms of order R cubed over R to the 4. I think I've got that right.
Provided you don't have an acceleration.
Yes, okay. I'm going to admit I have a prejudice to not having acceleration because there isn't any acceleration in gravity. So everything moves along geodesics.
Excuse me, could you say, what do you mean by acceleration? Since you said it's inertial, locally inertial.
Not now.
Okay.
I don't want to talk about acceleration. Okay. So anyway, I find THZ coordinates very convenient to use. Ian and I know how to find them. And the paper's almost finished. And so when the paper's finished in a week or two, you can read all about it. And the details are really not all that exciting. So I decided not to, I want to change the topic. And what I want to do is talk about second order calculations because those were raised spontaneously yesterday. And I'm going to mention that the first time I talked about second order calculations, cell force calculations, was in Oxford in 2005. And I've talked about them at every single CAPR meeting since. I went back before my laptop gave out on me and looked at my old talks that I'd given, and every single one of them, I had some bit in there about the second order force. But this year I thought, nobody's ever interested in that, so I'm going to do something else. And so I had decided to pass it live, but because it came up spontaneously yesterday, and because I had, issues with my computer, I thought I would give a summary of how I view the second order cell force calculation to work. And I don't see any particular issue with it. Do we need to do a second order cell force calculation? It depends on what you want. It's clear this kinds of stuff that Dory's been doing is clean, precise first order cell force calculations with real meaning behind it. On the other hand, those problems are rare, and I've yet to see something that see a result which is of the form of here's the cell force, and maybe it's a cell force, but I don't know what to do with it. I don't know how to use it in any effective way to tell me something about physics or gravitational waves or something. So having said all of that, but I know some people have other points of view on it, so I don't want to actually preach too much about it. But anyway, second order might not be necessary, but it sure would be a good thing to be able to do. And so what I'm going to talk about is basically a scheme which allows second order cell force calculations to be done with only a little bit of extra work by numerical relativists. People who know already how to do the Einstein equations this would be much much easier system of equations to have to solve. Okay, so having said all that, I'm now going to outline sort of in some way how this system goes. So I've got G is, I'm not putting any indices on it, anything, so I won't make any mistakes with those. And the Einstein tensor is just G, and this is the exact Einstein tensor for this network. And so I'm going to say I've got some background network G, and I've got another, we'll call it perturbation H. And this is the exact Einstein tensor for that sum. But I can write it as an expansion then, where this is, again, the exact Einstein tensor of the background. And we're assuming we've got a vacuum space-time, so this evaluates to being zero. And then we've got a first-order piece, which is G1. And there's the geometry that the that you're using in order to construct the operator. And that operator is operating on H, is the way to think about this. So for example, G1 looks more or less like box H plus a Riemann tensor times H, and then some other terms depending upon what gauge you're in, things like that. Or else this, maybe this equation looks like the Reggie-Wheeler equation if you're doing odd parity perturbations of Schwarzschild. So that's what H, that's what G1 is. It's just something nice and straightforward linear wave operator. Then we've got the second order pieces, and so this is again, this is the background geometry, and H is showing up here, and so this term is of order H, and this term is of order H squared. These are all the second order ones. So these look like things like H grad grad H, or grad H grad H, terms from the Landau-Lifshitz stress energy tensor show up there. And pretty much the third order pieces, I don't think I've ever seen anybody isolate them. But they could be, but anyway, I don't know anything about them, and I'm not going to talk much about them. So the Einstein equation, then, is the G is equal to 16 pi times our stress tensor on that side, and that's what we'd like to be able to solve. But in this expansion, then, and now I'm going to do first-order self-force analysis, and this is the way, back in 2005, that I was talking about it in Oxford, about how to do self-force problems, although I was doing second order then also. But this was the way when I started thinking about this effective source that we like to use for self-force calculations. So this piece is then zero. I'm now doing a first order calculation. So I write out, there's my G, my first order operator on 16 pi. But I break it up into two pieces, an HR and an HS. HS is something I know analytically, because I did these expansions using the THZ equations, so I know HS analytically, but I can split this into the two pieces then, G plus HR, or G and HR, and G and HS, there's 16 pi T. I take this piece, move it over to the right-hand side, and I've got the wave operator on HR is equal to this quantity, but this is precisely constructed so that the right-hand side here is continuous. It's not differentiable in general, but it's continuous. And that tells us that our HR, when we solve this equation for HR, it's guaranteed to be C2 at the location of the source, and it's C infinity everywhere else. And so this is one extra derivative for free, more than what you would need to, say, calculate a self-force. So this is one approach to doing first-order self-force calculation on a computer, and we've done some of these things involving scalar fields and stuff so far. But what I'm really interested in is the going to second order in the calculations. And so with second order, it's a little bit more complicated doing this split. And first I'm going to say there's a singular piece, and I can a singular HS. And again, I now write it as two pieces, a first order singular piece and a second order singular piece. The first order singular piece is exactly the same one I've been using over here, and that's in the literature. This one isn't, and I'm not going to tell you how I get it. If you want to ask me, I'll tell you later, or I don't know, but it's completely straightforward. It's just an extension of the ideas I used to get the first order piece.
But this is a second order singular piece that has some properties that I'm going to invoke in a little bit. So here's my Einstein equation written out. Now I take this term and I break it up again. Here's the background geometry, so that goes away because we have a vacuum background. Here's the first order piece for the regular field. Here's the second order operator on the regular field. And here is the first order operator for G plus HR. So I brought the regular part of the field, ends up going in and is sort of disguised as part of the background geometry here. And what that allows me to do then is to pick up pieces which are actually second order in H. There's going to be an HR and an HS in it. And there are also pieces which are first order in HS from the background geometry in HS. And I'll say that the singular field is something which is known analytically at any time in this whole scheme. There's a specific expression that one can derive for the singular field. It depends on what you define as the singular field. I write an exact equation, an exact expression, but it's it is the quote singular field only to a certain order. So I've got that second order in HR. I've got this as being the sort of funny mixed piece showing up here. Here's the second order in the singular field, and then there's my stress tensor. And so this is essentially the Einstein equation written out through second order in the H's in both of them.
So the second order T will be quadratic in H. And I don't think you've accounted for have you accounted for the cross terms?
I think that's showing up here.
That's what that is.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is basically, and that ends up all the cross terms between HR and HS show up in that expression.
So is that operator, the same G1 that you have there, but just
actually? Yes. So this is some operator, and it's the same operator in the sense that it depends upon a background geometry. But when I've written it this way, I've brought HR into part of the background geometry, which is where it belongs, because particles move along geodesics in the geometry, and that's what we're trying to take advantage of here by bringing that in. So I now go, and we're going to take this piece and leave that on the left-hand side, and that's going to be all alone on the left-hand side. Everything else is going to get moved to the right-hand side. So in particular, this piece, which is second order in HR, is now on the right-hand side, and now you're solving a nonlinear wave equation for HR. So HR is going to have both first and second order pieces that are going to be combined together by virtue of the fact that we've got this nonlinearity showing up there. The other parts now, let's see, this is the same as that. I just grouped this is that, and there's my 16 pi, and I put all these things on the right-hand side, so I've got a minus sign there, and so I've got a minus sign there too. Okay, now we're getting to the punchline. 2 minutes? What's that? Three. Okay, that's plenty. Okay, so I've still got the wave operator. Again, this is just the natural second order piece that we would expect to show up for the nonlinear Einstein equations. This particular combination here, because of the features of HS1, and HS1 depends upon HR showing up here. So again, there are some of these second order pieces that are showing up. But together, this combination is going to be of order MR over R to the fourth. It looks just like this piece over here. It's scaling the exact same way. These other two pieces, and this gets a little bit, I'm just going to say it's a little bit confusing. So I took HS, and the first order part of HS went in there. And it's the fact that it's the first order HS, that cancels the delta function of the mass sitting over here with its the delta function on the world line. And the piece that's left over is the second order self-force, and the singular field, rather. And HS2 is designed precisely so that this combination ends up being m squared over r to the fourth. which is to say, and this is at the location of the particle, it's seen infinity everywhere else, but where the particle is, it's discontinuous. So what we end up with is a source which has some second order pieces to it here, some second order pieces to it there, and this piece over here as well. This is the first. This is the first order piece for the most part. It has some second order pieces also, but most of it is first order. And this ends up again looking the same way that we have over there, and it's the second order piece that has the discontinuity, that has a discontinuous source. So at the end of the day, the field that we end up is end up with HR is going to be C2 at M at order H, and it's going to be C1 at order H squared. So the second order piece is only going to be differentiable at where the particle is. Okay, so I'm going to claim, even though I left out all of the details, in particular what HS is, I'm going to claim that if you work your way through it, this will all make sense. And you end up with something that is, any numerical relativist ought to be happy to try to solve an equation where the nonlinearity is sort of sitting right there in front of you and not having to worry. And you can get some interesting, I'm going to say you can solve some real interesting problems, really see waveforms and stuff. And the waveform will all show up in HR. Because this is just the source you've got over here, and HR has both first and second order pieces mixed in together. Okay, that's it. Thank you.